Now, in the scriptures, believers eating together is a well-established practice. Trying to think how far back in the scriptures we could go. We could even look at Abraham when the two, or the actual three, angelic beings came to his tent as they were on their way down to Sodom to destroy it, and he quickly rushed and fixed a meal for them to eat together with them. And the Israelites eating before they left Egypt, God providing food for them while they were in the desert, a number of the feasts and holy days and even sacrifices that the Jews kept at their tabernacle and then later at their temple involved eating together as a part of that. In the New Testament, Jesus ate continually with his own disciples, even as he led them and taught them and ministered, instituted at the Lord's Supper in the midst of another feast that they were eating. And we know in the early church that as 1 Corinthians tells us, they often gathered together to eat. And Paul even had to put some regulations on that because it became something unholy, because it became very carnal in what they were doing. And yet the thing itself was a blessing and a something that really honored the unity that we have in the body of Christ. Today we have our second lesson in our series on the Epistle to the Ephesians. I'm calling this series Riches Beyond Measure, because the word riches appears at least five times in the book, and the concepts behind that are throughout the entire epistle or letter that Paul writes to the Ephesians. And even though it's a very small book or letter, just six chapters, it is one of the three great doctrinal epistles of Paul. It, along with Romans, and if you believe that Paul wrote Hebrews, each of them present in great detail the doctrine concerning the gospel of Christ. Romans having to do with how we're saved by faith and how this has always been God's plan and purpose. Hebrews to show that everything that came before was only pointing to Christ and the church. And in Ephesians, to talk about what glorious things God has provided and still has in store for us because we are in Christ. A part of understanding and appreciating Ephesians is going to be knowing something about the city and the people of Ephesus. And yet knowing about the city and knowing about the people is going to be difficult if we read only the New Testament. That's not a failing on the part of the Scriptures. It was just not the purpose of the Scriptures to give us detail, historical, geographical, cultural, and other kinds of information about all the many different peoples and places that are named in it. After all, those who were doing the writing, like Paul, and those who were receiving the writings, like the Ephesians, already knew those things. And for several hundred years after the New Testament, it was still well known in that part of the world, the details about this great city. And that's true not only of Ephesus, of course, that's true of Rome, of Corinth, of Philippi, of Thessalonica, of every single book addressed to a city or a region of the New Testament area that was written to. So we're going to take some time this morning to learn a little bit more about the city. And I think in the process, you're going to start seeing then, as we teach from the book, how what we say today connects and why Paul says many of the things he does in just the way he says them. You know, I don't quite know what to think about something I see that's come up out here in our part of the country, Cowboy Church. Now, they sometimes have slightly different names for them, but, you know, that's essentially what it is. And, of course, the idea, I suppose, behind it for those who have organized these things and are overseeing them is that many people out here have this Western way of life and they understand this more casual, different way of living. And so why don't we make church that way, too? And I'm not here either to commend or to criticize that, but it's just a matter, I think, of them trying to connect to something people are already familiar with. The same is true in the book of Ephesians. Paul is connecting to some people who had a certain way of living and a certain place where they lived and a certain culture that very much understood then what he was saying because of the way he said it. And so let's learn a little bit more about the city of Ephesus. First of all, we can review briefly what we know from the scripture itself. The first time we find, I believe, Ephesus mentioned in the scriptures is during Paul's second missionary journey. And that would be in Acts chapter 18, at least that portion of his second missionary journey, when he is coming back from his trip through Macedonia and Greece for the very first time. Remember when they had he had come through the interior of what today we would call Turkey. In New Testament times, what is today Turkey was broken up into a number of different provinces and states, all under the Roman control. But he had traveled through the interior of Turkey and got as far as Troas when in a dream at night he had this vision of a man of Macedonia saying, come over and help us. And so they immediately made plans to cross over that small little portion of the Mediterranean over to Macedonia and to Philippi. And it's at that point Luke joins them for the first time. And he has a fruitful ministry in Philippi, very briefly in Thessalonica, Berea, and then makes his way through Athens and into Corinth. And then as he makes his way after a certain length of time back the same way he came, he crosses back over to the mainland of what was called Asia in that time, this particular province, and makes a brief stop in Ephesus. And so it says in Acts chapter 18 and in verse 19, they arrived at Ephesus, where Paul left Priscilla and Aquila. He himself went into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to spend more time with them, he declined. But as he left, he promised, I will come back if it is God's will. Then he set sail from Ephesus. And so on his second journey, he just makes a brief stop there. We're not told exactly how long, perhaps only just a week or so. But he promised if it was within God's will, he would come back. And certainly he did. On his third missionary journey, as he again comes through this part of the world, again visits Macedonia and Greece and the cities there where churches were established, he finally makes his way back in chapter 19 of Acts to Ephesus. And he spends some 3 years there. 3 years in ministry in Ephesus. And a number of significant things happen during that period of time, which reflect something about Ephesus itself. We find that after about 3 months, the Jews, who were the ones who earlier said, teach us more, they kick him out after about 3 months and start persecuting him and those who believed the things that Paul was teaching. And so he goes instead to the hall of Tyrannus, it's called, an educational institute there in the city, apparently. And for 2 years, he teaches almost daily there in a what we would call a university. But he teaches the things concerning Christ and the gospel. And during this period of time, significant miracles were done by the hand of Paul. And even some who had believed the gospel gave up their witchcraft and their black magic and so forth and came and brought the books and potions and spells and so forth they had written in books and on pieces of parchment and made a great pile of them and burned them. This obviously impressed the whole city because these things were of great value and were something that was very common in the city of Ephesus to have people who practice magic or sorcery or witchcraft or the selling and buying of spells to relieve people of health ailments or bad business dealings or whatever it was that they had going for them. And then there's a riot in the city because the city has at its very center, and not physically at their center, but at the very center of what the city was all about, was this great temple to a pagan idol by the name of Artemis or Diana. And not only was it at the center of the city's very life, but it generated a tremendous amount of revenue for those who made their living buying and selling things that was connected to the temple. It was almost like going to Orlando and Disney World or Epcot or something like that. Everything down there revolves around the tourist trade. Well, in Ephesus, so much revolved around the so-called tourist trade of people who came to visit the temple Artemis. And so this trade was being impacted as more and more people were believing the gospel and leaving these pagan beliefs. They were impacting the finances of those who made their living that way. So there's this great riot, and the huge crowd gathers in the theater that's there in Ephesus, another significant thing about the city. And the city clerk has to call the crowd, first of all, to calm down, because this was not a planned, organized, approved gathering of the people. And the Romans were always suspicious of any crowd that gathered without official approval. But also their reason for gathering, if it was something that was a legal matter, could be handled by the courts. And if it was not a legal matter, then they needed to disband altogether. And yet, this sort of signaled the time for Paul to find somewhere else to go. Certainly, he had done his work in that city. It was time to move on from there. Later, we'll even find that when he gets back down to Jerusalem, and there's a riot in the temple there, you recall, in Acts chapter 21, the riot sprang from the fact that someone from Ephesus saw someone else from Ephesus with Paul. Jews had come from Ephesus to worship at the temple, and they saw in the city Paul with a man by the name of Trophimus, I believe it was, who was from Ephesus as well. But Trophimus was not a Jew. He was a Gentile who had converted to Christianity and was with Paul there. And these Jews believed that Paul had carried Trophimus into the temple with him, which would have meant a Gentile in the temple, which was not allowed. And so that's what the riot broke out over. In truth, Paul hadn't carried Trophimus in there, but it's hard to tell a mob that. They're not listening. But nevertheless, Ephesus gets mentioned at that moment when Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, mentions Ephesus twice, because he writes the letter to Corinth. The first and second epistle to the Corinthians was written from Ephesus back when he was there. He mentions Ephesus twice in his letter. Of course, we have the epistle itself, which we're going to be focusing a lot on over the next several weeks. But then when we get to 1 Timothy, we find Paul also mentioning to Timothy. By the time he writes 1 Timothy, we think that Paul almost surely has been arrested there in Jerusalem and thrown into jail, and later moved up to Caesarea. And after 2 years in prison in Caesarea, is transferred to Rome itself for trial, where he also spends 2 years. And it's during some of that period of time, it's a little unclear in my mind at the moment whether it was while he's in Caesarea for 2 years or in Rome for 2 years, he writes the first letter to Timothy. And the very first thing he tells Timothy is, I left you in Ephesus to continue the work. And then his second letter to Timothy, which happens some probably 2 or 3 years after the first letter, Paul's back in prison again. He was released from Roman imprisonment when he got to Rome the first time and was there 2 years. But eventually he's arrested and brought back again. That's his second imprisonment. He'll die that time. But in his second letter to Timothy written during that time, he also mentions Tychicus, Trophimus, Onesiphorus, and others who were all from Ephesus, who either were with Paul in Rome or had been with him, and then he had sent them on to do other works in other places. So clearly, Ephesus was some place that was very much on the mind of Paul. Not only because he worked there for 3 years and had visited there one other time, he had stopped by, remember on his last trip down to Jerusalem, he had actually stopped by at Miletus and had just sent for the elders from Ephesus to come down and meet him there in Acts 21 and met with them and gave them one last, that's Acts 20 rather, gave them one last bit of encouragement, and they prayed together and wept together because he says, "You'll see my face no more." And so they were very much on his heart. And so we find him mentioning them in his letters, both to the Corinthians as well as to Timothy. And then much time passes in the New Testament. We get down to the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation begins with Jesus dictating letters to the seven churches of Asia. Asia being this proconsular Asia, as it was called, this state or this province on the western end of Turkey. It was actually a province of Rome called Proconsular Asia, the capital of which was Ephesus. And all seven of the churches, including Ephesus, that are mentioned there in Revelations 2 and 3, are all cities in that province over which Ephesus was the capital. And so even the last book of the New Testament has Ephesus in it. So for such a small book, six chapters, it obviously played a big part in what was happening in New Testament times. The city itself of Ephesus, located on the western edge of, as I say, modern-day Turkey, is located today, the ruins of it, just some 5 to 6 miles inland from the Mediterranean. And that's a rather interesting thing to say because in New Testament times, Ephesus was a seaport. Not because it was located literally right on the Mediterranean, but because there was a river called the Caistor River that the city was built along the edge of. And this Caistor River opened out into what became a harbor that then went on out to the sea. And in the period of time before the New Testament, the Ephesian people had spent a great deal of effort and money to clear out and clean out that harbor so bigger ships could come in, which made it a very significant place of import and export for that whole region of the world. And so in New Testament times, it was a seaport town because it had this sort of an inland harbor that another mile or two out to the Mediterranean proper. But in the centuries since then, as first of all, the city declined in later centuries and finally was abandoned. I think it wasn't until the Middle Ages when the city was actually abandoned after it had been destroyed by earthquake. And then when it was rebuilt in a smaller, a less significant way, was actually conquered by the Turks and others and destroyed again, that it was finally abandoned. Then the river finally filled in all of that harbor. And today it's all solid land, all the way out to the Mediterranean. So now it's inland, but it wasn't that way in New Testament times. But it's the ruins of the city today, and it was in New Testament times, located in a fertile valley, surrounded or protected on all sides by high hills and mountains, which made it rather secure from enemy attack without great effort. Located along the banks of the Caistor River, its harbor formed by that river reached out to the Mediterranean. The city was actually established as a city 1,000 years before. And while we don't know exactly when, but at some point, maybe 700 to 800 BC at least, people began to worship this goddess Artemis or Diana in that place. It seems that at some ancient time in human history, an actual meteor, they've been in the news lately, you know, a meteor had actually fallen from the sky and landed there. And since they believe that was an act of the gods, somehow they had eventually associated that with Artemis herself. A temple was built on that spot. And it was long believed and still believed by many scholars today that probably underneath the ruins of the original temple would be the remains of that meteor. Certainly even, I think in New Testament times, some stone was often put on display there in the temple, and people were told this is what fell from the heavens. And so they began to worship this goddess, and as the city grew and it became more prosperous, the center of trade and commerce, and eventually a center for government and so forth, the local people constantly were told and came to believe that all of these blessings came because of the blessing of Artemis, that Artemis was blessing them because of her presence there. And so this temple that was built, it got destroyed a couple of times, once by a fire, another time by enemy attack. Each time it was rebuilt more significant and beautiful than before. Finally, the Romans came into this part of the world, and they originally conquered the area around Ephesus around B.C. 191. They then sort of, by benign neglect, let it enjoy a certain amount of independence until around 133, they came back in and reasserted their control over it again. And so that brought us down to the period of time just before the New Testament, when Rome goes from a republic to a empire, or almost, you know, and ruled instead of by a form of a limited republican government by an emperor. And so we have Caesar Augustus. Of course, Julius Caesar was the first, and then he's followed by Caesar Augustus, his adopted son. And during the reign of Caesar Augustus, he made Ephesus the capital of the Roman province of proconsular Asia, as it was called in New Testament times. That happened in 27 BC. Government offices were set up there. Taxes were collected there. A significant Roman force was usually stationed there to keep peace in that region, not because the Ephesians were rowdy or revolutionaries or anything, but just to establish Roman presence there. Roman roads were built that all ended at Ephesus, and they went out like spokes of a wheel from there into all the area around it. It is estimated that about the beginning of the New Testament, around 1 AD, that the population of Ephesus had grown to about 250,000 people. That made it the second largest city in the Roman Empire, behind Rome itself. The third largest was Antioch, which is also has a significant part to play in the New Testament. By the end of the first century, the population had swollen to between 400 and 500,000 people living in Ephesus. It was a huge city for that period of time. In many ways, it was a very modern city. If you take a little time to look it up in an encyclopedia, or if you access the internet and look up things there, then you'll see many pictures of the ruins of ancient Ephesus. In fact, Ephesus is often referred to by the Turkish government as their largest outdoor museum. They've made the whole area a national treasure. But even today, the ruins and remains that exist of that New Testament city tell us something about it. It had wide avenues carefully laid out, much of the city. It had these wide avenues that were paved and lined on both sides with large pillars that made them very impressive to look at, and made it easy for people and trade and so forth and troops to move back and forth. Two of those avenues still exist in part today. One is called Marble Street because most of the paving is literally marble. And what's left of it today is over half a mile long. And another street called today Caretas Street is over 1 kilometer long, which is, you know, about 5/8 or 0.62 miles long. And that's one of the most common pictures you see of Ephesus today, is this stretch of a street, a wide paved street with the pillars lining both sides of it that still exist even today. That's Caretas Street. That tells us a little bit about what this city was like. The city had 4 major aqueducts that brought water into the city. It had one of the most advanced water systems known in the ancient world. Water was brought into the city, not just for basic things such as water for drinking or cooking or bathing, but they actually had water-run mills in the city. The water was used to turn different kinds of devices which in turn allowed them to operate ancient forms of machinery, including one that actually processed and finished marble, and they ran saws with these water wheels that then turned the saws that cut the marble into slabs. They had running water. The wealthy people had literally running water in their homes. They could turn the tap on and have water. They had a sewer system, huge pipes laid underneath parts of the city. And they had indoor toilets, the rich people did. The poor people had public toilets. You could go, and the number of them have been discovered, and the remains of them still exist today, where you could, you know, leave your house and go down to the public toilets. These were not outhouses like, you know, I grew up in the country and I know what those are. These actually had running water that flushed away the waste and so forth. They had public baths where people would go, and these were places both for socializing as well as a very practical function of people taking baths. They were located all over the city, hot and cold running water in them. They were a modern city by any standard that we might use. They had two large marketplaces in the city. One was primarily built around the government offices, the judges, the tax collectors, the places where you went to get licenses to do things and paid customs and all sorts of things. This was a large public square with these offices located around the edge of it. People often would come there to socialize and to visit, and vendors would have their ware set up for sale and so forth. But in addition to the government agora, as it was called, there was actually a real agora that was sort of the main shopping center. Now, all through the city, no doubt, there were little vendors and little stores where people made and sold and bought things. But there was this large shopping area called the agora. Parts of it still exist today, in which literally hundreds of merchants would set up their wares brought from the far reaches of the Roman Empire and sell everything from foods and spices to clothing and jewelry and carts and horses and whatever you wanted to buy could be found there. Asia had their own games, just like over across the water. They had the Isthmian Games and the Olympic Games. In Asia, they had the Asian Games, and they were held every few years in Ephesus. This brought in even more tourist trade. It also meant they had the facilities to sponsor that and to support that. They actually had a Roman stadium that was built there to host many of these games, whether they were the athletic events like running or javelin throwing or even chariot racing. And in later times, the Romans themselves even brought in the, not associated with the Asian Games, but the gladiatorial type sports as well, where men fought with men, or animals fought other animals, or men fought animals and so forth. That was all there in Ephesus. The city had three great landmarks. Two of them existed in New Testament times. The third one was built after the end of the New Testament, but was certainly there during the early generations of the church. First, it had a theater. That's the one mentioned in Acts chapter 19, where the people all rushed into the theater. It's the best preserved theater from the ancient world. It still exists today there. It could seat between 23 and 25,000 people. And it was built in that fan shape. You've seen the pictures of it. 25,000 people sitting there. And yet, when something was taking place on the stage, even if you were sitting on the back row at the top, you could hear every word that was said without the speaker having to shout, because it was almost a near perfect audio design, so that sound carried so well. the back of the, because it was built in the side of a hillside, and Ephesus was, had these hills that surrounded it. Then, the back part of the stadium was some 38 meters, which is some 120 feet higher than the floor down at the bottom. That's 12 stories tall. A very significant, important, landmark and archaeological feature. Secondly, and this was not built until after the New Testament period of time, but around, I think it was AD 112 or so, a prominent Roman senator by the name of Celsus. He was one of the first Roman senators, by the way, who was not Roman. He was actually Greek. He was a very, very wealthy man. He was also very much into education. And so he gave the money to build a library. And so today there exist the ruins of the Library of Celsus in Ephesus. It was completed around AD 135. It contained more than 12,000 volumes. It was the third largest library in the world in its day. Only the libraries of Alexandria and Pergamum were larger. Not even the libraries in Rome were as large in terms of the number of books that it contained. So only for us today, 12,000 books don't sound like a lot. But when books were made by hand and only the very wealthy could even own one book, 12,000 was a large, large library. He not only gave the money to have it built, he left in his will the money for it to be maintained. And he's buried underneath it. That became his mausoleum, was this library. It was apparently this beautiful building. The remains today is mostly just of the facade, the front of the building, a two-story facade, which is kind of interesting because the library was actually three stories tall inside. So it was an illusion to see on the outside two stories. And when you went inside, according to the descriptions that still exist of it today, you went to this large open atrium area. And it was around the sides where the parchments and the books were kept. And there were stairways up to the second level and the third level that lined the sides. But the big middle area was open all the way to the ceiling. And it's even thought that probably at the middle, at the top, the roof was open, which seemed like that would be a little dangerous for getting things wet and so forth. But it gave great light inside because of the natural lighting. And in later generations, the early church fathers and so forth knew about this library, and some of them even had access to it. So that was the Library of Celsus. But then the third and greatest architectural feature of Ephesus was, of course, the temple to Artemis herself. Built on the edge of town, it was built out of the side of a hill. And the temple and the grounds of the temple were so large, there was not enough flat area to build it. And so they had actually come in and did an architectural wonder. They had built a huge platform coming out from the side of the hill, supported by an innumerable number of pillars that went all the way down to the ground below. And of course, every pillar had to be a different length, because the ground underneath was uneven, and that even laid down material underneath these pillars in such a way, because this area had earthquakes so commonly, that when there was an earthquake, the ground shifted, but everything moved together. And this tabletop they built with this support of these pillars underneath existed for 400 years without falling during earthquakes. And yet on top of this tabletop then was this large grounds with altars and places for tens of thousands of people together. And then this great temple setting at the back of it up against the hill. And the temple of Artemis in New Testament times was this classic Greek Parthenon looking building. If you know what the Parthenon in Athens looked like. This Parthenon-looking building, but larger. I believe I read somewhere that the Parthenon has 60 pillars, 60-something pillars, maybe 69 pillars in it. The Temple of Artemis had 127. I don't know where the odd one was, but it seemed like it should have been an even number, but 127 pillars. The pillars of the Parthenon are 13 meters tall. The pillars of the Temple of Artemis were 18 meters tall. That means almost 60 feet high, each pillar. And if I recall correctly, each of those 127 pillars was unique and different. No two were alike. And each one had been built from the donations of some wealthy person, and it bore their name carved into the pillar. The temple proper covered an area some 450 foot long and 225 feet wide. That's four times the area of the Parthenon. And inside of this huge building supported by all these pillars and this roof covering it all, in the center of it, in a large open area, was this large statue covered in gold of Artemis, the goddess whom they worshipped. Around 140 BC, a man by the name of Antipater of Sidon made a list of what he considered the seven wonders of the world. We still refer, even all these years later, to the seven wonders of the world. And he's the one that made up that list. And on that list was the temple of Artemis at Ephesus. And he said of the seven wonders he had seen, the temple of Artemis outshone them all. He said it was the greatest of the seven. So this is what the city was like. This is the place where the gospel is going to go. If the gospel is going to make it anywhere, it's going to have to succeed in large urban areas like this. And the three largest urban areas in New Testament times were Antioch, Ephesus, and Rome. If you think about it a moment, where were the three places the Apostle Paul went and devoted much attention? Antioch, Ephesus, and Rome. Because the gospel can't just be in little rural areas, small towns and villages and farming communities and everything. It needs to succeed in the major modern cities of its time, and it does. For the next 400 or 500 years, the centers of Christianity will be at Antioch, Ephesus, and Rome because of the work of the Apostle Paul and the other early Christians. And so Paul can say there in Acts chapter 20, as he's talking to the elders at Ephesus, this last time he visited them and in which he won't see them anymore. He says, Acts 20:20, "You know that I have not hesitated to preach anything that would be helpful to you, but have taught you publicly and from house to house. I have declared to both Jews and Greeks that they must turn to God in repentance and have faith in our Lord Jesus Christ." Clearly, he was successful. The gospel had a great impact on each of those cities. And then out from those cities, the gospel went throughout the rest of the Roman world. The wealth, the glory, and the power of this city was renowned. Paul will use all three of those things, wealth, glory, and power, in the book. In fact, you might well say that's what the book is about. But it's not about the wealth, glory, and power of Ephesus. Instead, it's about the wealth, glory, and power that believers in Jesus Christ enjoy. He knew that to reach the average Ephesian, whether they were among the wealthy, and we read clearly that he had reached some who were wealthy, or whether it was among the common man, and certainly the greater part of the converts came from them, he had to help them see that what they were being offered in the gospel was something of far greater value, far greater riches, and a far greater magnificence, and coming from a far greater power than what they already had when they worshiped the goddess Diana at Ephesus. That's why he writes as he does in the book, because of the city to whom he was writing, the city where he had spent 3 years of his life, and where some of his companions for the rest of his life came from and worked together with him diligently and served the early church faithfully because they had converted to Christianity. Well, next week we will spend more time talking about Paul's work in Ephesus, because it also helps us understand what he's writing in the book itself. Kevin has an invitation song for us. Certainly, Paul often extended the invitation, so to speak, to those Ephesians when they heard the good news about Jesus Christ and the great wealth that was there and the ancient power that had been at work to bring this all to fruition, just like the Ephesians often thought about the ancient power of Artemis from the days when that meteor had first fallen and all the centuries how they'd grown and become greater because of that. They thought that was all because of Artemis. They need to know that someone had been working a lot longer who was a lot more powerful than that to make something even more significant happen. And that was to make them right with the one true Almighty God and to preserve them for eternity.